Well, welcome again to another talk. And I did mention last time I'd give part two of Anapanasati Sutta, the final episode of the breath meditation. And yesterday I made a lot of attention on the preparation and also teaching just how we can first of all recognize the feeling of the breath, what we're supposed to watch. Now that's one of the most difficult things to get around. So you're not following the feeling of a nose and not a belly, but feeling of the breath wherever it happens to be. In just the same way, you've got to be like one of these, like a CIA person. So you're supposed to be following the breath, but you know that these terrorists, they're very sneaky. And even though they're a guy, they go into the girls' toilets. So if you're following it, it's not supposed to go there. You're supposed to follow it, you know, wherever it tends to go. Yeah, the breath, maybe it should be up here. But sometimes the breath is sneaky and it goes to places it shouldn't be. So it doesn't matter where the breath goes, you have to follow it. And that's just like the spy, the CIA man. If a suspect goes in the girls' toilets, the CIA guy has to go in the girls' toilets too. Otherwise, he may lose it. And that's what we have to do. So we follow the breath wherever it happens to be. So in other words, we're with the breath. And it doesn't have to be anywhere. Wherever it is, that's where we put our mindfulness. Because again, one of the reasons why people lose the awareness of the breath, because they're watching here and it's somewhere else. They watch here and it's over here. And it can be very sneaky. So you have to watch it wherever it happens to be. And that's why if ever I lose my breath, I ask myself, am I breathing in or am I breathing out? If I can ask that question, I must still be breathing, so there must be an answer. If you can't find the breath, it means you're dead. So that doesn't, that's a possibility, because you just asked a question. So it means the breath is there somewhere. Your job is to find out where it is. And once you find out where it is, you've got it, it's there for you. So that means you can always find the breath. So, am I breathing in, am I breathing out, how do I know? And then you get the breath. And then you follow that feeling. Now, sometimes, again, when you're beginning, it's hard to find the breath. So even Ajahn Chah said this. He said, like, breathe in unnatural breath. And of course, you always find the breath when you breathe in unnatural breath. And this is one of the reasons why in the Anapanasati Sutta, the 16 steps taught by the Buddha to full enlightenment. Trouble is that people don't even do the first step, or rather they trip over at the first step. That's why they never get to the last step. But the first step is like they say, like knowing a long breath or knowing a short breath. All that really means is you're just getting hold of the breath, getting to know it. So you do a long breath, you do a short breath, whatever breath you want to do, just so you can get to know the breath. So when it's unnatural, it's very prominent. But of course, if you've already got enough experience of watching the breath, you don't need to do long breaths and short breaths. Just your natural breath is more than good enough. And that's what you do. But actually, just to make a point, just before you even start watching the breath, they have this word in Pali. It's one of the reasons why people get confused about the tip of the nose. They say to establish mindfulness, paramukha, which literally means, like she to... So you can either say, sorry, purakata, either put it in front. That's what it really means. Put your mindfulness in front. And sometimes people think, because Westerners, we're in here, so we think put our mindfulness up here in front of the nose. But it doesn't mean that. It means establish mindfulness as a priority. In the same way the English word priority means it's top of your list. It's in front of you, in front of everything else. So that's what it really means, to make mindfulness a priority, first of all. That's why we do present moment awareness and silence, to get mindfulness up before we start watching the breath. And then, when you watch the breath, the mindfulness is established enough, it's easy to do. And if it is still a bit rough, you just do a long breath or a short breath, just to make sure that you've got some sort of awareness of the breath. Then you let the breath become natural and just follow it. For some people, that even that is difficult. So there's all these other tricks, and one of the tricks is counting the breath. And because modern people, they've done lots and lots of maths at school, they don't mind counting. I know there's quite a few accountants and people who run their own businesses here. So people love counting. So you can do the counting of the breath. Now, if you want to play around with this, because it makes the life interesting when you're watching the breath, the one which I develop was you breathe in and in one, out one, in two, out two, three, three, four, four, five, five, in six, out six, seven, seven, eight, eight, in nine, out nine, up to nine, then you start again, in one, out one, two, two, three, three, four, four, five, five, in six, in seven, out seven, in eight, out eight, then you stop at eight. Then in one, out one, two, two, three, three, four, four, five, five, six, six, in seven, out seven. Then in one, out one, two, two, three, three, four, four, five, five, six, six. In one, out one, two, two, three, three, four, four, in five, out five. Then in one, out one, in two, out two, in three, in four, out four. In one, out one, in two, out two, in three. In one, out one, in two, out two, in one, out one. One whole cycle. It's amazing. Whenever I say that, people really pay attention. Because, you know, it's something you can do. At last, you give me something I can do. Something I can get my intellectual head around. So you do that, and you can do that. It's a good little fun. So you can do actually 45 whole breaths you've watched to do that whole cycle. But you have to be quite firm with yourself. If you lose count, in three, out three, am I on six, I'm on five, where am I? Then you've got to start all over again, from the very beginning. And sometimes you will notice, it shows you how much mindfulness you haven't got, when you're in there saying to yourself, in 16, out 16, in 17, out 17. You've totally lost it. But at least it tells you you're not really mindful. But that's just a little way you can play around. But if you do that, don't do it too much. It will give you a headache. Just maybe at the most three cycles, about 5 minutes maximum. And then if you still can't, you know, count, then just get up and walk or go to bed or have a cup of tea or do something. Have a cup of coffee to give your brain some boost of energy. But what it means is that it's just a nice way of little starting. So the counting the breath, there's many other ways of counting the breath as well, which you can do. Or you can do like the mantras with the breath. You know, the one which was very famous in Thailand was Buddho, breathing in Buddha, breathing out Ho. And that because the Thai people for Buddha was a really important word, just the very sound of it really grabbed your mind. For Westerners, that doesn't work so much because, you know, we haven't got so much faith. We haven't been brought up in Buddhism. So the word which I like people to use when they're watching the breath, they're doing a mantra, is as you breathe in, you recite the word to yourself, shut, as you breathe out, up. Shut, up. Shut, up. That's amazingly effective. Because it means something to you. And it's a bit playful. And actually, after a while, you get the message, okay, shut up. And you become quiet. So now all of those little means, and I gave some other little mantras yesterday, you can breathe in, more serious, breathing in peace, breathing out, letting go. All those sorts of things, they come within those first two steps of Anapanasati, just, you know, breathing in, knowing a short in-breath, breathing in, knowing a long in-breath. It's those first two. Just getting hold of the breath, getting to know it, getting familiar with it. And then, again, I said yesterday that what happens, the third step of Anapanasati is the sutta. This is how the Buddha described it. So I'm linking what I said yesterday to what the Buddha said and then taking it further. The next step is when you see the whole breath, the whole thing of the breath, from beginning to the end. So it's without any gaps. Just like you watch my finger going from one side to the other side. You see the whole lot. That's the full awareness. Just partial awareness. If you finger, then you go off here, you go off there, and then you catch it again before it gets to the end. This is a full awareness of all the different sensations of breath from one in-breath. Now, of course, that takes greater mindfulness, but it's not that hard to do. And sometimes I've seen people who have, doing some carpentry, and they're totally focused on what they're doing. Or you may be doing some artwork, some painting or something, and you're totally focused. Now, every movement of that brush, you're there with when it happens. It's not that hard to be that mindful. And many of you have got things you really love doing, and you're totally immersed in it. You are mindful, fully mindful. So what that means, from all the sensations of one breath, from the in, beginning of the in to the end of the in breath, and I say seeing the gaps between the breaths, it's important to see those gaps between the breaths, because that's usually where the mind wanders off, because it thinks there's nothing to do. So off it goes and does something else. So in those gaps between the breaths, they're important because, number one, that's where you wander off, and number two, that's where you're getting very sensitive to subtle objects, because no feeling going on there. It's like an emptiness, it's a nothing type feeling. And that becomes very important later on in the meditation, to be able to become able to notice subtle feelings, to be able to notice emptiness, nothing happening, whatever. So then, of course, it only lasts for a second or a bit longer, then the out-breath begins. You see it from the very beginning, right to the very end. You become very, very aware. Now, one of the reasons that this works is because you're focused. It means that sort of you get very peaceful and very happy. You've only one thing to do. Imagine going to work and you got all these letters to write, all the phone calls to make, all the reports to do or to sign, you've got all this work on your desk. If you ever gone to work in the morning, have you ever thought of just putting the whole lot, sweeping the whole lot with your arm off and just having one thing on your desk? Oh, what bliss. And that's what we're doing here, just one thing on our desk. Just the breath and nothing else. Oh, what bliss. So you don't have to think about anything else. And also, once it starts to get joyful, we get what happens when we focus. When we focus, everything else except what we're looking at fades away and disappears. And here I bring up the simile of the TV screen. Now, if ever you go on an aircraft, you see those little screens in front of your seat. They're tiny screens. But people are very happy seeing tiny screens. But in your homes, you've got these 20-foot wide plasma screen TVs. Now, I challenge you that next time you go traveling, you notice that when you see that tiny screen, after a short while, you can't notice the edges of the screen. You're actually inside, and the edges have just disappeared. Exactly the same when you watch this big plasma screen TV. Only when it's turned off, when there's nothing happening on it, do you realize how big it is. But when you're watching a movie or the soccer match or whatever else you watch, you'll find that it's exactly the same perception in your mind as a tiny TV screen. People only notice how big the TV screen is when it's turned off. When they're turned on and you're watching, all sizes look completely the same in your mind. See if you can notice that. Because what happens when you first watch the TV, okay, you've got this, I remember when I used to watch TVs, had this box and a picture of, you know, your parents' wedding on top, or from flowers or something on the top, and underneath you had sort of the VCR or the magazines. And then you notice that once you turn the TV on, you know, the photograph on top disappears, you can't see it anymore. And even the sides of the screen vanish. You don't know whether it's a wooden side or a metal side screen, the frame. And in fact, if you did this experiment and you had like circular TV screens, or like triangular TV screens, or I don't know what other ones, like rhombus or whatever TV screens, you'll find it will make absolutely no difference. Because once it's turned on, your mind goes to the center and everything on the periphery disappears. That's just the nature of focusing. In the same way, if you all focus on my nose, after a while my ears disappear. You can't see them anymore. Actually, I was just focusing on Phil, and you disappeared. That's what happens, because whatever you focus on, everything else just falls apart, away, and you can't see it. That's the nature of focusing. So this is what happens when you're watching the breath, the full awareness of the breath. You're so focused on the breath that everything else falls off the screen, just like on a TV. Which means the people sitting next to you, they just go beyond, outside of your radar. Even sounds, they fall away, because you're just watching the breath. And even your body, because the breath is inside, and everything on the outside just fades away until it all disappears. That's what happens when we focus, which means that we don't have so much business which grabs our attention. And that means that everything gets very calm and very peaceful, the fourth stage of Anapanasati. You're just watching this breath and it becomes very peaceful and very nice, and there's not many things disturbing. You're beginning to focus. The next stage of Anapanasati, as the Buddha taught it, I always say this is the most important. Actually, the fifth and sixth stages, where you're breathing, experiencing piti and sukha, the happiness and joy of meditation. And I don't know why this is there in black and white. It's there said so many times. I don't know why people, when they start to enjoy meditation, they think that something's going wrong. And why people say, oh, you're enjoying yourself, you'll get attached to that happiness. That is ridiculous. The Buddha actually said this is what's supposed to happen. This is to be expected, it's to be encouraged. So when it happens, don't think you're doing something wrong. You're doing something right. Well done. You're happy at last. What's wrong with being happy? You don't all have to be depressed. That's one of the reasons I like Buddhism. Now, when I went to Christian churches, now they were all hard pews, stone, they were cold and really boring, and scared the life out of me. Now, you know, I'm a sinner, I'm going to go to hell. Oh God, that's not very nice. You go to Buddhism and say, yeah, you can forgive, and it's nice and happy, and the monks and the nuns tell jokes. And there's like happiness, joy, was part of the experience. But there's still a lot of people think that if you're smiling, you're not serious. That unless you're suffering, you're not a real Buddhist. Which is absolutely crazy stuff. You know, I recently went to Hong Kong last February to teach a retreat over there. And at the end of the retreat, there was a Mahayana nun who came up to me and said, thank you, thank you, thank you so much for coming here. You know, you've been smiling and making us laugh all week. You know, now I can smile and laugh as well. Before you came, every time I smiled or laughed, people told me off. You're a Mahayana nun. You shouldn't smile. And it's a true story. I said, now I can smile and laugh. Thank you so much. There's some traditions that's like that. You know, sometimes it's far too serious. And this is actually just really powerful stuff because you're getting joy and happiness and this starts coming up in mind. So be prepared for that. As you are meditating, you're just watching this breath go in and out, it starts to look delightful. It's what I say, the delightful breath. And when that happens, I call that one of the most important stages in meditation. The pivot point, the tipping point, whatever you wish to call it. Because from there on, you're really getting into your meditation and having a good time. You like meditating, you can sit for long periods. Why? Because it is fun. It is joyful. And you have a great time. And sometimes people just think, gee, why, Ajahn Brahm, why are you a monk? For fun. You get immense joy and happiness out of this lifestyle. You know, but you know, you take it seriously, you take it deep. It's not superficial, but it's very deep happiness. And I explained what that happiness was in one of the earlier talks. The two parts of the mind, if you remember, the doer and the knower. The doer and the knower. All the energy usually gets eaten up by doing. That's why you get tired. And that's why you get dull. And that's why if you really do too much, you get depressed. The reason why there's so much depression in the modern world is directly proportional to how much activity people have, especially at work. You all know that these days you have to do much, much more work than you did, say, 10 years ago. You get more tired, which means you get more people depressed. They just run out of energy. And they get to such a low state, it's hard to get it going again. But there's that doer and that knower. The doer takes too much of your energy. So there's not enough left for mindfulness, for awareness, for just sheer being. And because the knower has got so little energy, there's not so much happiness and fun. Now, when I first went to Northeast Thailand, it was one of the poorest places in the world I'd ever been. Subsistence farmers, no electricity, no running water, just dirty toilets. Whatever the rice they would, they get the rice in the rainy season retreat and have to keep it all. Hopefully it lasted, and then just whatever fish they caught during the rains retreat, then they would pickle them, for the rest of the year. That was the pla dek, the rotten fish. Tasted awful, smelt disgusting, but that's what you used to eat. And there was subsistence. But some of the happiest people I've ever seen in my life were those farmers. And that was, obviously many people have seen that before. People going to very poor countries in Asia, villages which have hardly anything, and seeing how much happiness people have. But these days, it's not there anymore. You go to the northeast of Thailand, and people aren't happy. They haven't got the same smiles I used to see when I was first there. Because in those days, they weren't doing very much. They really knew how to relax. Sometimes during the hot season, when there was no water around, they couldn't do anything. They'd be sleeping under their huts, their little houses. And you'd ask them what you were doing, and they would say, Yususa, which was Laotian for just being. And that was the usual say, what they would say. What are you doing? They said, just being. And they did that for days. So they really knew how to relax, and that really gave them a lot of happiness. Because they worked very hard during the rainy season, but the rest of the time they realized how to relax and enjoy themselves. The stress of doing so much wasn't there. They knew how to stop doing and just be. Without feeling guilty. When I was a kid, it was a Christian saying, the devil makes work for idle hands. No, he does not. Idle hands make you enlightened. Too much busyness is our problem. That's what sort of causes all the problems. But because of that, you feel guilty sometimes. Do you feel guilty when you're meditating? You think, here I am doing nothing, and all these starving people in the world, all these people who need sort of someone to help them, to raise money for this and to look after the floods in Thailand, the earthquakes in Turkey, or whatever else is happening in this world. I should be doing something. That is the guilt trip. Shut up. It's very nice when you're peaceful. Please remember that if you're peaceful, you're giving a lot of happiness to other people because they don't have to put up with you. So being still is your great gift to others. So don't feel guilty about being still and being happy. Because when you are still, when you don't do so much, when you can relax and you don't feel guilty about it, energy starts going back into the knower. So when you're meditating, just watching the breath go in, breath go out, you're hardly doing anything at all. Which means that the energy starts to flow back into the mind. You're more awake, more energy, and more happiness. The breath becomes delightful. It's just what happens. It's gorgeous. Now, I love telling this story every time. I'm just going to lead up to it with a few pre-stories. What will happen during this retreat, if you really get into the meditation, is that everything will start to look really gorgeous and beautiful. One of the first times that happened, when I was in Thailand, walking meditation during the rainy season, in the hall, on this concrete floor. And I was walking, I was getting very still and peaceful. Then I had to stop. Because that concrete floor was a work of art. I don't know if you've ever seen concrete. I mean, really seen it. But there's so many different shades of grey. And the whole thing is like contoured. It's like a mountainscape because it's never even. And the different colours of grey, the way they are positioned next to each other. My God, I never noticed that before. That was absolutely beautiful. And I stared at that piece of concrete for about 10 minutes. Without moving, just enjoying, like it was some work of art. I even thought I should get a concrete saw, so I'd cut it out and send it to the Tate Gallery in London. It was that beautiful. And you think, what's going on there? Is this guy on some sort of illegal substances, some drugs? Are they putting something in the the water or the tea in this Jhana Grove retreat center. What's happening? And all it was is the nature of the mind, when it really gets still, the energy gets so powerful that even a lump of concrete looks incredibly beautiful. And that leads up to the classic story. Once on a retreat, I got so peaceful, so still, I just so much happiness and joy. And of course, I had to go to the toilet. And after going to the toilet, I just by chance, I looked in the toilet bowl. Wow! Look at that piece of shit! I never seen anything. It's not just one colour, it's all different shades of brown. And the texture of it, because when it's got a little bit of slime on the outside, it actually, it's like a diamond, it reflects the light, and it sort of sparkles in the toilet bowl. And just even the way it was all put together, you know, it was just amazing. And I was standing there saying, wow, I know it's one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. To press the button and send it into the sewers. Oh, that was really letting go. And I'm not saying, because that's a true story, I'm not exaggerating. It's the most delightful turd I've ever seen. And of course, they're all the same. It's just because your mind is powerful. And you see, anything looks delightful. So can you imagine just watching your breath? Oh, that's incredibly. Or you go outside, and you've got to be careful, because once you get into these stages, you look at just like a blade of grass, or if there's a flower outside, that blows you away. Oh, it's incredibly beautiful. Enjoy it. You deserve it. The mind is waking up. And you start to see beauty where you've never seen it before. And it's fun. It's deep. It's profound. And you're learning a lot about the nature of your mind. Of how that by being still, you're getting very deep insight. You really are seeing deeply into things. And you see some beauty which you don't expect to see. And that's really important with the breath. Because the breath becomes so delightful. Just like just watching that piece of shit. I was totally focused, one-pointed on it for 10 minutes. Nothing could disturb you, because that's what happens when there's delight. It's the delight is the glue which sticks your attention onto the object. Before that time, you use willpower. You force the mind onto the object. But once you have delight, you don't have to put any effort in there at all. In fact, if there is any effort, the effort is to take you away from that object. It takes a lot of effort to pull yourself away. The delight keeps you very, very stable. So you're just watching that, doing absolutely nothing, because you don't need to do anything. You're enjoying it. Now, the trouble with many people these days, they're so into attaining, so into getting more, that they can't even enjoy the bliss of that stage of meditation. They want more. Give me more. I want more. Please be content. This is good enough. Just be happy to be able to watch the breath, as happy and peaceful as you've ever been in your life. And then you get more. Because that's actually how it works. When the delight happens in the meditation, and you really feel it deeply, which is the seventh step, when you start to sort of calm down, then all of the breath disappears. The breath gets so smooth. What's happening here is because you're watching every moment of the breath, and it's delight. The delight is what you're really watching, rather than the breath. It's that aspect of the breath called the happiness. And then the whole thing vanishes, leaving only the happiness. Years and years ago, I was trying to find a simile for what actually happens. And the best simile came from Alice in Wonderland. The simile of the Cheshire Cat. Because Alice saw this Cheshire Cat, which was like a smiling cat, sitting in a tree. And it would suddenly disappear. And then suddenly come back again. And Alice said, "It really gives me a headache to see you coming and going so fast." So the Cheshire Cat said, "Okay, I'll disappear slowly." And so the Cheshire Cat started to disappear. First its tail disappeared, then its legs, then its body, leaving only its head. Then its ears disappeared, then its whiskers disappeared, and then its whole head disappeared, leaving only its smile. And Alice said, "A cat without a smile, I've seen that before, but I've never seen a smile without a cat." It's a very, very clever little book, Alice in Wonderland. But I thought, exactly, that's what's happening in meditation at that particular stage. The smile is left, but no one left to do the smiling. The smile without you. Because the body's disappeared, but the happiness remains. It's a beautiful sense of peace and joy. So when the breath does disappear, if you have developed the delight and happiness, it's very easy once the breath disappears to know what happens next. The problem with many meditators, somehow or other, we're either afraid of delight and happiness, or we've got into our head, it's something wrong, something to be attached to, it can't be right, I'm enjoying myself. Now, religion is what we do when we're not enjoying ourselves. But no, this is the joyful part of it. So somebody once told me, you're come from the United States, the Puritans started the United States, they founded the place. And someone once sent me the definition of the Puritan religion. The definition of Puritanism is the fear, and it's all based on fear, the fear that somewhere, someone is happy. And that was actually very profound. Somehow or other, that we are either afraid or said of guilty of being happy. And already some person has asked me this in the interviews. Sometimes when you get to that delight, you think, I don't deserve to be happy. And that has occurred many times. The Dalai Lama talks about that as well. They think, oh my goodness. Now, the Western culture is really dysfunctional. When we are happy, we can't enjoy it. We think there must be something wrong. Now, that's been very deeply psychologically ingrained into us. The fear and rejection of happiness. Which is why a lot of people do find it difficult to smile and laugh. I know many times I've told a joke and the person's just looked at me. Stony face. They know it's funny, but they refuse to laugh on principle. <They're> crazy. It's a funny joke. Laugh. It's allowable. So, it's allowable to be happy. So, sometimes if that delight doesn't come up, you ask yourself why. It's there for you, but you reject it. You think it's something wrong. Which is one of the reasons you have to do a lot of these talking about letting go of guilt, flushing down your past, on a piece of toilet paper into the toilet bowl, letting all that go, keeping all the eggs from the past, not the shit, so you actually feel good about yourself, enough to allow yourself to be happy. And so that when that meditation does get to that stage, you permit piti sukha to arise. And it does. And you deserve it. And you have a great time. If that's not happening, just check whether you're giving yourself permission to be happy. And when it does, when that happens, the breath gets very peaceful, then it disappears, having a great time. And then the delight is left. And that appears, it's the delight in the mind. This is mental joy. Remember, it's a knower. The mind gets all the energy. And that gets so energized, it appears in your mind's eye, like a beautiful light. It's the nimittas, the beautiful lights appearing in your mind. And they're joyful, because that's just the mind has been energized. It's joyful. And just that's how you experience it. How most people experience this beautiful light coming up into the mind. That is the ninth stage of anapanasati. Experiencing the citta, experiencing the mind. The five senses have disappeared. So just like that similar to the emperor, the clothes are off. Now you can see what your mind is. It's beautiful light coming up. does not matter what color that light is. It does not matter what shape it is. It's just a light, that's all. And you're not seeing it with your eyes, you're seeing it with your mind. One of the reasons why I put no windows in this hall was that so that, you know, if you see a nimitta, it must be a nimitta. It can't be the sun. Okay, you know, the sun's up there somewhere. You know, you can't be seeing it. There's no windows. It's a nimitta. Accept it. It's amazing how many people say, oh, well, I saw it. No, it couldn't be an nimitta. Not me. It's just the negativity we have. We don't give ourselves a break or the benefit of the doubt. So, 99% of the time, because I've been teaching a long time now, 99% of the time when people say they see a light, it is a real nimitta. It's very, very rare. Maybe in 1% of cases, you know, it is a light. You know, some sun is shining on, or reflection of some car headlights or something. But most of the time, it's a nimitta. Nimittas can come up too early. So, you know, just don't be interested in them. But if you follow the path, you know, you'll be watching the breath, and it's become so delightful, having such a wonderful time, and then it disappears. Then nimitta comes up. They're the good ones. They're the ones which are useful. They're the ones which are coming up in the right order. Okay, and for me, it took a long time to understand what that light was. Now, even though the Buddha said it's, you know, it's a citta, it's your mind. Now, the Buddha actually said, this mind is radiant. Prabhasarajita, that's it. It's this beautiful radiant light. You're experiencing it. It's obvious afterwards. But first of all, because you're still not stable, that light will come and go. That's what happens at first. You know why it happens at first? It's because you get too excited. Hello, I've got an imitator. I've got an imitator. La, 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 la. I've got an imitator. And then you blow it because, you know, you're not still and stable. These things happen because of stillness. So, shh, don't move. You have to be like this famous simile from my teacher, Ajahn Chah. A great simile. I can't improve upon it. Never heard anyone improve upon it. The still forest pool. Okay, remember still? Forest, pool, a lake, a pond has always been the simile for your mind. I mean, in all cultures, you know, like a lake, a pond, a body of water, especially in the forest, that's a simile for a human person's mind. But Ajahn Chah used this from his own life. When he used to go on this wandering as a monk, he used to find a lake or a river late in the afternoon because you want to wash and maybe rinse out a few robes and get some water for drinking. So you'd always be aiming to find a lake or a pond somewhere in the evening. So very often you find that lake in the forest, in the jungle somewhere, or a river. And then you'd wash and rinse out some clothes, replenish your water bottle. Then for the evening you have these mosquito nets. You set them up maybe 10 or 15 meters away from the water's edge. And you meditate there all night and then go to bed and go to rest. But sometimes you stay up in the late evening just watching the animals come out to play before, you know, those nature channels, or what are they called, National Geographic? You know, those channels on TV where you watch the animals play around. Before those times, the only way you could see those animals is in real life. So he would actually sit very still in his mosquito net umbrella, maybe 15 meters from the water's edge in the evening, and watch all the animals come out and play. But they'd only do that if he sat still. Because if he moved, they would know there was a human being there. And for the animals, most human beings in the jungle would mean hunters who would kill them. So they were terrified of humans. So if he moved, even though they may be thirsty, they wouldn't come out. They'd hide in the jungle. But being a monk, he could sit very still. And that meant they could all come out and play. I remember not going into the jungle to do this, but I remember in this one monastery in the north of Thailand, very remote, you know, in the jungles, high up in the mountains. I remember just spending the retreat there, range retreat there, and I would always put a bowl of water out for the birds to drink. I know you see the birds, you know, the way they drink, all over the world. They go in and they drink, and then they jump in, and they flap their feathers all around and have a great time. And I sort of put the bowl of water out. And only in a couple of days, they all found out where there was water. And I would watch them through a knot hole in the wooden planks of my hut, so they wouldn't realize they were being observed. And so through the knot hole, I watched them. It was delightful to watch. And after 2 or 3 days, an amazing thing happened, which totally surprised me, that those birds of so many different species actually formed a queue. They all were standing in line. It's unbelievable, but it's true. They'd all stand in line, and the one who came first would drink and wash, and then the next one would take its turn, and they'd wait patiently in line. But there was always, you know, one bird would come every evening, would try and jump in the queue. And of course, as soon as it jumped in the queue, all the other birds, they would jump on that bird, peck him and drive him away. And once they got rid of that sort of queue jumper, then they'd all come back and wait in queue again. It's so cute to see the birds do this. That's actually what happens in nature. Just, you know, watching animals in nature is just delightful. So imagine Shelby watching these animals play. He had to remain very still. And then he said sometimes after those ordinary animals had come out to play and drink, sometimes he said some very strange and rare animals would come out. But he had to be incredibly still, because these were so shy. That's why not many people had seen them. If they smelled or perceived a human being around, they would never come out. But sometimes he was so still as to be invisible. They couldn't see him. So they came out to play as well. These strange, weird animals, his parents and teachers had never told him that these things existed. It was so enjoyable to watch them play by the still forest pool. Those are the nimittas and the jhanas, these very rare and wonderful animals, which come and play by your mind only if you're still. If you say, a nimitta, a nimitta, a nimitta, the animal runs away. Jhanas, jhana, 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 jhana. No, it's gone. That's why. For me, that was a great simile because, you know, people said, be still, and I couldn't really get it. But when they say, imagine you're sitting by, you know, a lake and the animals are coming out, I could actually do that. I could imagine that. It made it possible. You knew exactly what to do, to be still. And what happens when you're still, that nimitta becomes still. If that nimitta is moving, it means you're moving. It's a reflection of your mind. Just like looking at yourself in the mirror in the morning. If the image in the mirror is moving, it's not the mirror's fault. It's your fault. You're moving. So if you see that thing in the mirror moving backwards and forwards, don't try and hold the mirror still. That's actually a profound simile which I developed, which helped me enormously stabilize nimittas. I realized I, the watcher, the knower, that had to be perfectly still, and then this nimitta will be still. That's called the 10th stage of Anapanasati. The 11th stage. Samadhang Chitang. Stilling that nimitta. Keeping it still and stable. The one before that is Sampasadanang Chitang, which is literally making it more joyful, more bright, more beautiful. To make it more bright and more beautiful, there are many tricks. Because there was this one disciple in Malaysia. Poor guy. Actually, some of you know him, so I better not tell his name. I started teaching like this, and he could get a nimitta coming up in his meditation. But after I told him this, he came up to me and he was very, very disturbed. And I said, why? And he said, you know, you just told me that when you actually see this jitta, this nimitta, it's a reflection of you. He said, when I saw my nimitta, it was so dirty and grubby. And I said, what have you been doing? He said, exactly. He'd been misbehaving, I forget what. I better not say what he did. But, you know, breaking precepts and being a bit selfish and indulging. And this is actually what happens. When that nimitta comes up, there's no possibility of distortion or denial or wishful thinking anymore. It's right in your face, literally. They actually see just how pure you've been. And if you have been naughty, if you haven't been kind, if you haven't been generous, if you've been cruel to someone or cheated someone, you see that straight away. Your little light is dirty, smudged. But there is a trick, which I'll talk to you. And that trick is this, and it's a very good trick, and it's a very powerful trick as well, which to use in the whole of your life. Yeah, you may not be perfect in your conduct. You may be a bit selfish and angry and, you know, irritated. Maybe somebody's banged the door in your cottage today, and on purpose you bang the door back when you know they're having a spill. You know, the sort of stupid stuff which people do. And that makes your liver a bit dirty. So what happens is, it's not all of that light is dirty. There's always one part which is more clean, more bright than the rest. And what you do is to incline towards the beautiful part, the brighter part, the clean part. And just like that symbol of the television, if you do to the bright part, all the rest of it expands. You just go into that bright part. And in that bright part, you go to the brightest part of the bright part, the cleanest part of the clean part. And you keep on going that way, and soon you've got this incredibly beautiful nimitta. But you notice, a lot of times people aren't positive at all. Years ago, I went to accompany Ajahn Sumedho to teach a retreat in this mining town in the north of England called Darlington. It was only a weekend retreat, and when we went there, people were surprised because they say, now this was actually, I think, just during the recession years in the UK, you know, just before Margaret Thatcher was a prime minister there, closing down all the coal mines there. So it was a very sort of bad time for work. And people said, what are you doing coming to Darlington on the weekend? Everybody leaves Darlington on the weekend. And in the mornings when you went for a walk, you know, Ajahn Sumedho is in a positive mind. I've got a very positive mind. So we went to the park, we went to the flower gardens, you know, went to all the beautiful parts. But there was another monk who was there at the last retreat, and he went down to the old canal, the gas works, and the defunct industrial area of town. And the person who was hosting the retreat said, you know, that is typical. That guy is always so negative and dour. If he goes for a walk, he'd more like go to the cemetery and go to the beach. And it really shows your inclinations. What are your inclinations? Are you a person who always looks for the positive, who always is going to give people the benefit of the doubt, see their goodness and beauty, or are you always going to see their faults? If you see the faults, you've got what we call in meditation the fault-finding mind. If you have a fault-finding mind, you see the faults, you know, in the people in your cottage, you see the faults in the food, you see the faults in this place, you see the faults in me, but worst of all, you see the faults in yourself. And you get into a very negative mind. And that's the person, they see this nimitta to come up, they always go for what's wrong with it. The opposite of the fault-finding mind is the appreciative mind. Yeah, it may not be the best retreat, but it's good enough. It may be not the softest of cushions, but at least you don't have to sit on that thing. It may not be the best jokes, but you know, it's just all you're going to get, so you might as well enjoy it. When you've got that positive mind, the appreciative mind, a mind of gratitude, you'll be someone who sees the nimitta and you'd always go to the beautiful part. So look in your life. What do you incline towards? Incline towards finding fault with people? Or incline with, you know, seeing their good qualities? And you know, you do have that choice. And if you do develop that positive mind, always seeing the good bricks in the wall rather than the bad bricks, you know, giving yourself that benefit of the doubt, not just seeing what might go wrong, but what might go right, then when you see a nimitta, just automatically, even if it is not the perfect nimitta, you go to that part of it which is perfect, and that will grow. And that will take you into enormous amounts of delight. This is what we mean by abhipamojayang jitang, bringing more joy, bliss, power, beauty into that nimitta. But I must also say that, again, teaching many retreats over many years, there are some people, you know, these are members of our Buddhist society, because I've known them very, very closely for many years, who are really, really pure-hearted people. And I don't need to explain what a pure-hearted person is. You know people who are really so kind, you know, that you ask them for something, and then they'll say, oh, I'm busy. They'll say, oh, yeah, I can do that for you, even though they are busy. You know, people are always generous, always there cleaning up after the retreats, always there helping. You know, those really, really good, pure-hearted people, when they get their nimitta, that's where they get the payback. Their nimitta is absolutely gorgeous. And they can so easy get into deep meditation. They deserve it. Because now they're actually seeing themselves. Seeing this beautiful, beautiful nimitta. And my goodness, it's incredible. It blows them away, literally. So that's actually the payback of being a really kind, generous, good, helpful person. And being generous is not just putting donations in the box. That's the easy part. It's being forgiving to people who have hurt you. And spending time with people who really need your help. Just going that little bit extra for somebody else, even though it's tough for you. Really good-hearted people. That's why virtue is important for meditation. If you're really, really good and kind and generous, when you get to that nimitta stage, you get your reward. Brilliant, beautiful mind. And this is where you start to get the big pleasures of meditation. Because when that nimitta gets really strong and stable, it's the most beautiful and wonderful thing you've ever seen. You're out of this world. You're not seeing actually colours which you can ever see in this real world. And if it is, say, a blue or a gold or a white, it's much, much more powerful and rich than any of those colours you can ever see with your eyes. This is a mental object. And sometimes it's so brilliant. I don't know how many people, I remember this myself, thinking, I'm going to go blind. It's like looking in the sun, which the sun isn't 1,000 times brighter. You can't stand this. But don't worry, you're seeing it with your mind, not with your physical eye. And other times it's become so blissful. Sometimes I think I can't take any more bliss. That's happened many times. You've been sitting there just, I'm totally blissed out. And you think, I can't take any more happiness. No human being can endure so much bliss. But one thing I found, one of the great insights, is you can always take more bliss. So don't worry, get into it, enjoy it. So it gets incredibly powerful and blissful and very still and deep peaceful. And then actually you go into it. It emerges right into its center. And that's where the jhanas happen. In the jhanas, you're totally apart from the five senses. Senses have totally disappeared and gone. So, you know, the sounds, they can't really get to you. Feelings in the body, mosquitoes can be biting you. Or like sometimes happens, you know, because, you know, it's the end of the retreat, we need to clean up. They pick you up and they put you in your room for the time being. And so, you know, you went to meditation in this room and you end up, so in the hall, you end up in your room. How did I get there? Oh, we just picked you up and dumped you there. You don't feel a thing. You're having a great time inside, so you don't feel anything. It is really deep, beautiful meditations. But you are perfectly mindful. But not of the five senses. You're mindful of the sixth sense, deep inside the mind. This is the start of the jhanas. But that, again, is another talk for another time. I just wanted to get you into these nimittas, first of all, and don't be afraid of them. If they come, you try and control them, and they'll run away. You've got to be the Ajahn Chah by the still forest pool, leave them alone. And those of you think, ah, yeah, and I've been coming here for years. I haven't even seen a tiny light, not even a flicker of a light, let alone these nimittas. Ajahn Brahma, here he goes again, blissed out of his head. Yeah, it's all right for him. He's probably born as a monk. Now you've seen that 60th birthday book of mine, you know I was not born as a monk. As an ordinary guy. But this is what can happen. And the reason I talk like this is because it can happen and it probably will happen to you. So I just want to give you just what might happen. This has happened to many people here already. But don't want these states. These are states born of stillness, of letting go. The more you want, the harder they are to get. In fact, they become impossible to get. The more you're content and still, more still, following the path, then it happens. And it's beautiful and you have lots and lots of fun. If you can't accept the delight of the delightful breath, you never get to nimittas. So start developing the delightful breath, first of all. As I said, the pivot point, the tipping point of meditation. So you're meditating with happiness and joy. And then that joy will start to grow. Nimittas happen. And when they do happen, you'll know what is occurring. And you won't be confused. I still remember that time teaching a retreat in Penang in the Hindurama temple. And Chow Pro said, look, there's a lady here. And, you know, she's really sort of in a mess. She's been to all the counselors, you know, in Malaysia. No one's been able to help her. Last resort, Ajahn Brahm, can you sort of talk with her? So she came into the room. She wasn't on the retreat, but, you know, sort of, I said, okay, I can give her 10 minutes. And asked, what's gone on? And then she started telling me what had happened to her. And that was a wonderful experience for me because, you know, she started saying all this and said, madam, that was a jhana. You just fluke one somehow or other. I don't know how you did it, but your description is a classic description of a jhana. And I gave her some more information about what she'd experienced. Yes, yes, at last, somebody's actually explained it to me. I thought I was going crazy. And then she's actually fluked a jhana. And a lot of people I've found have done that. They've got into these deep stages, got right inside themselves, and had an enormous amount of bliss, but come out, and because no one had told her what it was, she thought she was crazy. And even some of her friends have said she was crazy. And they hadn't understood, and you know, that made her a bit more tense and upset about what had happened. And all she wanted was someone who knew what they were talking about to tell her what was going on. And that was it. She was fine. No problem at all after that. And that's actually, experiences like that is why I like teaching these things. Because some of you will do it, and if you do do it, you know exactly what it is. And so you don't waste these amazing moments where you get into deep meditation. And later on I'll say what they mean and how they can turn into the most amazing of insights and understandings about the nature of life and the meaning of life. Not just sitting over here. But understanding why I say that is the meaning of life. It all comes very clear to you. So that's actually what happens when you get these deep meditations and jhanas. So there you go. See what happens now. Next time you go into the toilet, look inside the bowl. See if your mind is ready yet. And if it's nah, just brush it away and come back here and do some more meditation. Okay, so that's the talk for this morning. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. I got you all sadhuing the right way now.